or untie me, so I can cut out your lying tongue.
I've no interest in doing either of those things.
A smile pulled at his mouth.
I have a proposal for you, but I'd rather not talk about it here, in case whoever took your mother decides to return. What say we take our secrets elsewhere, little Dread?
Little? The moment she had the chance, she would knock him on his arse. Are you mad? She snapped.
Many have wondered.
He curled two fingers under her chin, made her look at him. His touch jolted her. She forced herself to lean into his hand. I hunt people like you, she told him with a slight, hard smirk.
Yes, and you do a fine job of it.
All humor in his voice died.
Tell me, Madam Dread, if I pledge that I will help you find your mother, in exchange for your assistance, will you join me?
Eliana tried to read him and could find nothing to go on. Join him? A ludicrous thought. She could not possibly trust him. And yet, if she refused him, if he fled the city and she went to Lord Arkellion empty-handed, what then? She longed to shut her eyes and have a moment alone to think. Mother, I'm sorry. God, I'm so sorry. I'm coming as soon as I can. I'll find you. I swear it.
I leave this city tomorrow, the wolf continued. And you might just get the shit kicked out of you for letting me slip through your fingers. So, you can join me or not. But either way, you won't catch me.
A small smile.
You want to find your mother, yes? Wouldn't it be smarter to do it with help?
Her thoughts scrambled and raced. Goodness me! What a night! The famous wolf needing help from a girl!
My mission begins tomorrow evening. Do we have a bargain or not?
Tomorrow is his lordship's naming day. There's a fete at the palace.
What a happy coincidence.
She narrowed her eyes. Only tomorrow night?
No. Our mission will be longer.
How much longer?
I cannot say.
Or you will not?
Those are my terms. Do you accept?
Her wound-up nerves felt ready to detonate. She managed a disinterested sort of sneer. Why me?
You know the palace. You'll make it easier to get inside.
And after that? Why bring me with you?
Because I need to move fast, and I need another killer on my side. Someone as good as I am.
Or better,
she says, bound on the floor.
You pulled a gun on me. I would have beaten you otherwise.
Perhaps.
Must be quite an important mission, she continued mockingly. And yet, you would risk trusting me.
I'm gambling that you won't risk losing your mother, he replied. The wolf had her there, and judging by the look on his face, he knew it.
And if I don't accept this bargain?
Then I will leave and never see you again, and you'll go on about your life here, if you can call it that. Unless they kill you for failing to capture me.
Eliana stayed silent to see what he would do. After a moment, he untied her wrists, discarded the bindings, and stood.
Well?
She calculated how long it would take to kick him, send him staggering, grab his revolver, and shoot. She'd never used a gun. They were rare, expensive, and she never let herself spend the money on them. But pulling a trigger seemed simple enough. 5 seconds, perhaps six. She could do it. She rose. And then she saw Harkin. He was coming in from the kitchen, his body dipped in shadow, his favorite dagger in hand. Behind him, Remy watched tensely from the kitchen. Harkin's gaze found hers, held firm.
I've got you.
I'll help you,
she told the wolf slowly. But only if I can take my brother with me.
Remy's eyes widened.
The little baker's boy,
the wolf frowned.
You can't be serious.
Eliana kept her face blank. Just how much did he know about her?
I assume we're stealing something from the palace, then delivering it somewhere. Some piece of intelligence. Wherever we're taking it afterward, Remy will come. You'll get him safe passage to Astavar, and do nothing to harm him. Or we've no deal.
He glared at her.
That wasn't my offer.
Yes or no, Wolf?
He tilted his head. His eyes caught the moonlight and made him look like something from one of Remy's more fanciful tales. A night creature, made of secrets and sharp edges. An empire monster for the Sun Queen to slay.
Only those who are frightened of me call me that. And you aren't frightened of me, are you?
Harkon approached through the shadows. One step, two steps.
Not even a little bit, she lied. So what shall I call you instead?
He inclined his head.
You can call me Simon.
Fine, Simon. And one more thing. My friend Harkon will come with us as well.
Behind Simon, Harkon raised his dagger to strike. Eliana flexed her fingers. Simon's mouth thinned, the only warning.
A turn, a shove, and then Harkon was flat on his back on the floor, Simon's boot pressing into his throat, his weapon in Simon's hand.
Him?
Simon pointed at Harkon with the dagger. The look he threw Eliana was one of profound disgust.
Your lover?
Eliana shot Simon a rakish smile.
Jealous already?
Let him go.
El,
rasped Harkon, struggling to breathe.
We can't trust him.
No,
she agreed.
But he can't trust us, either.
She held out her hand for Tuora.
Release him, or no deal.
Simon paused, then returned Tuora to her, and stepped away. Eliana slipped the dagger into the holster at her belt, knelt at Harkon's side, and helped him sit up.
Tell me more about this mission of yours, Wolf.
Information only as you need to know it, little dread,
Simon said.
Until then, do as I tell you, and I'll help you find your mother. You have my word.
The word of a rebel doesn't count for much.
And what about the word of a fellow killer?
He took off his glove and held out his hand.
Have we a bargain?
Eliana hesitated. If she accepted his offer, her life here would be forfeit. Lord Arkellion did not deal with defectors lightly, and Razavel would not allow her to disappear into the night. By doing this, she would be endangering not only herself, but Remy and Harkon as well. But if anyone could help her find her mother and get all of them to Astavar and to safety, it would be the wolf, with all of Red Crown, the very people she had spent so long hunting, at his disposal. If she played this right, she could keep Harkon and Remy out of the Empire's grasp for a few more years. She could elude Invictus, stay with her loved ones, find her mother, and keep them all safe. She searched Simon's eyes for lies and found only cold steel.
Eliana, don't agree to this,
Harkon rasped, glaring up at Simon.
We'll find Rose in another way.
But there was no other way. Eliana stood and clasped Simon's hand.
We have a bargain,
she said, and tried to ignore the way her skin shivered at Simon's touch, like the sensation of being watched from the shadows, or the simmering charge of a storm she could not outrun. Chapter 9. Rial. The seven saints combined their powers and opened a doorway into the deep, with wind and water, with metal and fire, with shadow and earth. And when Saint Catel, last of all, let fly her blazing sunlit sword, the angels fell screaming into eternal darkness. The Book of the Saints. The Hall of Saints was the largest, most sacred room in Bayngard. White stone pillars supported soaring vaulted ceilings, ribboned with elaborate carvings of suns and moons, trees and flames. The ceilings themselves boasted a map of the world of Avitus, Seldaria, and the other four nations of the sprawling eastern continent. North of Seldaria lay the Sunderlands and the Gate, and across the great ocean were the western kingdoms of Venterra, Astavar, and Meridian. On a tall, white marble dais at the front of the room sat the High Court's bench. Grand, high-backed chairs for the king and queen, an ornate, wide-seated chair for the Archon, the head of the church, and a multi-level gallery large enough to seat the members of every temple and royal council. Above the dais towered Saint Catel, the patron saint of Seldaria and all sunspinners in the world. Her right arm held up her sword, her casting, which was now hidden somewhere in Seldaria. Catel's other hand clutched a fistful of ragged stone feathers, angels, miniature and pathetic, their faces contorted in agony, crawled up the legs of her white mare, pleading to no avail. Around her head shone a halo of light, plated in gold, kept burnished and flawless. Saint Catel, the Magnificent, a sunspinner and, after the angelic wars, a queen, the unifier of Seldaria, loved by an angel but strong enough to resist the temptation of the enemy. And, in the thousand years since, the children of her line had sat on the throne. The other six saints lined the vast hall, three on each side. Gigantic and solemn, stone and bronze, they each carried their own casting and were framed by an element. Saint Nerida, water worker and the patron saint of Meridian, brandishing her trident as waves crested at her back, her kraken coiled at her bare feet. Saint Grimvald, metal master and the patron saint of Borgsvall, striking his way on dragon back through a storm of iron shards, his hammer in hand. And Saint Catel, riding her shining white mare. 20 armored guards stood at the foot of the dais, facing Riel. They were her father's men and women, people she knew by name. She felt their eyes on her, concerned, curious, afraid. "They are right to be afraid," came the voice, without warning. "But not you." Riel stiffened. In this environment, it was impossible to hear the voice without remembering the truth. Mind speaking was something the angels once did. Her skin crawled at the thought. So many people were staring at her that she could hardly remain still. Her father stood surrounded by a contingent of armed guards. Queen Genevieve, King Bastian, Ludovine. The Archon, serene in his robes. The councils, with the obvious alarming exception of Tau. And Ordric. He sat beside his parents, on the edge of his seat, as if prepared to launch himself off the dais in case of disaster. When Riel's eyes met his, he sent her a small smile, thin with worry. Riel relaxed slightly. "Ordric is here," she told herself. "He won't let them hurt me." She found the king above. The expression on his face made him look more troubled than she had ever seen him. King Bastian was a man of good humor. Riel had grown up to the sound of his laughter booming through the halls of Banegard, had screamed gleefully while he chased her, Audric and Ludivine, through their childhood playroom in countless games of Go Find the Mouse. There was no trace of that man today. Riel resisted the urge to wipe away the sweat gathering at her hairline. She curtsied low, her skirts pooling on the spotless floor.
Your Majesty?
Lady Riel Darden, King Bastian began. You have been brought here today to answer inquiries about the incident that occurred during the boon chase 2 days past. I will ask you a series of questions, and you will answer them truthfully in the eyes of the saints.
I understand, my king.
The massive room swallowed Riel's voice. King Bastian nodded, paused. The grey threading through his black beard and the laugh lines across his brown face made him look older than Riel had ever thought him before. Then his gaze hardened. Riel resisted the urge to take a step back from the new, dangerous charge in the air.
How long?
He asked, his voice cool and matter-of-fact.
Have you known yourself to possess elemental magic?
Somehow, Riel had thought this would begin with something less direct, a question or two, or five, that would give her time to find her voice. But at least, perhaps, they thought she was only an elemental, and not whatever she truly was. Maybe her punishment, then, and Tal's and her father's, would not be as severe as she had feared. The prophecy's words ran through her mind. They will carry the power of the seven.
Since I was 5 years old, she answered.
And how did you come to this conclusion?
He asked it so casually as though they did not already know the answer. A chair creaked as someone shifted their weight. Riel glanced over and found Tal's sister, Sloane Bellunon, with the rest of the magisterial council surrounding the Archon. She sat rigid in her seat, her dark chin-length hair looking unusually severe against her wan skin. She looked as though she had not slept. How must Sloane feel to know that her brother had kept such a secret from her?
When I was 5, Riel continued, I set fire to our home.
How?
I was angry. My mother and I had had an argument.
About what?
It sounded ridiculous, horribly small.
I didn't want to go to sleep. I wanted to sit up with Father and read.
So, the king said calmly, you set your house on fire.
It was an accident. I was angry, and the anger built up until I could no longer contain it. I ran outside because the feeling frightened me. It felt like something inside me was burning. And then, when I turned around, she said, the memory clawing at her, I saw fire consuming our house. One moment it had not been there, and the next, it was.
And you had caused this?
Yes.
How did you know?
How did you see your own hand moving and know it was attached to your arm? And your shoulder, and your blood, and your bones.
Like that?
I knew because it looked and sounded and felt like me, she explained. It felt the same as my anger had felt. The same scent, the same flavor. I felt connected to it. She hesitated. Grand Magister Bellunon has since helped me understand that what I sensed in that moment was the Imperium. The connection between myself and the fire was the power that connects all things, and I had accessed it. Riel dared to look at the Archon sitting beside the Magisterial Council. He stared back at her, his small bright eyes unblinking. The torchlight made his pale skin and smooth head gleam.
And was your mother able to escape? The king continued.
Riel's throat tightened, and for a moment she could not speak.
No. She was trapped inside. Father ran in to get her and brought her out. She was alive, but then...
Say it, child. The voice returned, compassionate. Tell them. They cannot hurt you.
With the stone saints staring down at her, their unfeeling eyes cold and grave, the strange voice should not have been a comfort. But hearing it nevertheless settled her churning stomach.
I was afraid, she continued. When I saw my mother, I had never seen Burns before. She was screaming, and I yelled at her to stop. But she wouldn't. And then all I could think was how I needed her to stop screaming. She hurried through the story, as if trying to outrace the memory of those climbing flames. Then she stopped. Father laid her on the ground, begged her to wake up. But she was dead.
The room shifted, murmuring.
And you have hidden this murder from us for 13 years, King Bastian declared.
It was not a murder, Riel said, wishing desperately to sit. Her body still felt bruised from the fight in the mountains. I did not mean to kill my mother. I was a child, and it was an accident.
We are concerned with facts here, not intentions. The facts of the matter are that you killed Maurice Dardenne, and you have, with the help of your father and Grand Magister Belunan, lied about it for 13 years.
If someone had asked me if I had killed my mother, and I had denied it, Riel replied, looking straight up at the king, then that would be a lie, Your Majesty. Keeping a secret is not lying.
Lady Riel, I am not interested in semantics. You concealed the damage you were capable of doing while you ate at my table, while you were schooled with my son and niece, and thereby placed them and all those around you in danger. Some might consider such a deception treasonous.
Treason.
Riel kept her eyes on King Bastian and her hands flat against her thighs. If he had meant to frighten her, he had succeeded.
And on the day of the race, said the king, not only did you start a fire when you attacked those men,
anger bloomed inside her.
If she was to be found guilty of treason, then she might as well earn her punishment. When I saved Prince Audric's life, you mean?
A louder murmuring rose from the gallery, but King Bastian simply inclined his head. Riel knew it was the only thanks she might receive, but it was enough to give her a bit of courage.
When you attacked those men, the king continued, you not only started a fire, you ripped open the earth, you carved sheets of rock from the mountains. One of the surviving races has described you gathering sunlight from the air using only your hands. Another claims you threw the assassins from their horses by no visible means she could detect, even though the assassins themselves were elementals. You easily overpowered them.
The king looked up from his notes.
Does that align with your own recollection?
Then they did know what she had done, that she was no mere elemental. Her jaw ached from clenching it.
It does, Your Majesty.
So then, you are not only a firebrand, but an earthshaker, a sun spinner. And also, perhaps, other things. I think you will understand our alarm as we contemplate what this means. No human who has ever lived has been able to control more than one element. Not even the saints.
A tiny spark of pride lit inside Riel.
"Lady Riel," he went on, "if you had been near a body of water during this race, would you have caused it to flood?"
"It is impossible to say if I would have or not, Your Majesty."
"Could you have, then?"
A flood. Years of lessons with Tal had shown her only hints of such power, and though she'd never been as strong with water as she'd been with fire,
"You know you could do it," the voice murmured. "You could flood the world. That kind of power hums beneath your skin, doesn't it?"
A cautious delight unfurled within her.
"Who are you?" she asked the voice.
It did not answer. She lifted her chin.
"Yes, I believe I could have."
A new voice spoke up.
"Did you like it?"
It was such a perfectly astute, perfectly terrible question that Riel did not immediately answer. She found the speaker severely handsome, fair-haired and elegant jawline.
Lord Derwin Sauvillier, the Queen's brother and Ludovine's father. Beside him, Ludovine sat poised and clear-eyed in her gown of luminous rose, lace spilling out her sleeves.
"Lord Sauvillier," said the King sternly, "while I appreciate your interest in these events, I have not given you leave to speak."
Queen Genevieve, auburn-haired, pale as her niece Ludovine, touched her husband's arm.
"However, it is a reasonable question if we are to determine how best to proceed."
Riel looked to the Queen and was rewarded with a small smile that reminded Riel of Ludovine, a Ludovine who had grown up not alongside Audric in the airy, sunlit rooms of Bayngard, but rather in the cold mountain halls of Belbrion, the seat of House Sauvillier. Queen Genevieve's gaze slid over Riel and moved away.
"I am not certain," Riel replied, "that I entirely understand Lord Sauvillier's question."
Ludovine's father raised a deferent eyebrow to the King, who nodded once.
"Well, Lady Riel, if you'll forgive me my bluntness," said Derwin Sauvillier, "I wonder if you enjoyed what you did on the race course, if you enjoyed hurting the assassins," he paused, "if you enjoyed hurting your mother."
"If I enjoyed it," Riel repeated, stalling. For of course she had enjoyed it, not the pain she had caused and not her poor mother's death, but the relief of it, that she craved. The rush of release through every muscle in her body. Those forbidden, blazing moments, practicing with Tal, running the chase, when she had known nothing but her power and what it could do. The shining clarity of understanding that this was her true, entire self. Sometimes she couldn't sleep for wanting to feel that way again.
"Your hesitation is alarming, Lady Riel," said Lord Sauvillier.
"I did not enjoy the pain I caused others," Riel answered slowly. "For that, I feel nothing but shame and remorse. In fact, I am appalled that anyone might think I could enjoy doing such things to any living person, let alone my own mother. But do the teachings of our saints not tell us that we should take pleasure in the use of the power that has been granted to us by God?" Out of the corner of her eyes, Riel saw the Archon shift at last, leaning forward slightly. It was as if Audric had been waiting for a signal from her, and he did not disappoint.
"My lord, may I answer her question?" he asked his father.
King Bastian did not look happy, but he nodded.
"The saints' teachings do indeed tell us that, my lady," said Audric, looking straight at her as if they were the only two in the room. And they also tell us that power is not something elementals should deny or ignore. Even when that power is dangerous, and perhaps even especially then, I, of all people, know the truth of that.
Riel said nothing, though she felt weightless with relief. With those words, Audric had shown her that he understood. He forgave her. The steady belief shining in his eyes warmed her down to her toes.
"With all respect, Your Majesty,"
Lord Sevillier said, and now he simply sounded exasperated.
"We cannot possibly compare this woman and her careless destruction of her surroundings with your son, who has consistently demonstrated unimpeachable discipline, and has not once let his power get the better of him."
A swift rage crested in Riel. "Perhaps the challenge facing me is greater, as it seems I am more powerful than our prince."
The silence that followed was so complete, it felt alive. Lord Sevillier recoiled in disgust, his mouth thin and angry. The king might have been carved from stone, like one of the watching saints. Riel waited, heart thundering. She wanted to look to Audric, but resisted. Finally, King Bastian spoke.
"Lady Riel, you are familiar with the prophecy, as spoken by the angel Ariava, and translated by Queen Catel."
Of course she was. Everyone was. "I am, Your Majesty," Riel answered.
"The gate will fall," the king recited. "The angels will return and bring ruin to the world. You will know this time by the rise of two human queens, one of blood and one of light. One with the power to save the world, one with the power to destroy it. Two queens will rise. They will carry the power of the seven. They will carry your fate in their hands. Two queens will rise."
The king paused. In the wake of the prophecy's words, the hall felt chilled.
"The most popular interpretation being, of course," King Bastian continued, "that the coming of the two queens will portend the fall of the gate and the angel's vengeance, and that those two queens will be able to control not only one element, but all of them."
Yes, of course. And everyone knew that too. Not that most people gave much thought to the different interpretations in modern times, if they gave the prophecy any thought at all. Riel was one of the exceptions. Often she had found herself reading the prophecy's words over and over, running her fingers across the scripted letters in Tal's books. A queen made of blood and a queen made of light. The Blood Queen and the Sun Queen, they had come to be called over the centuries. And now, after so many years, they hardly felt real. The gate stood strong in the Sunderlands, far in the northern sea, guarded and quiet, with the angels locked safely away on the other side. Queens from a prophecy might as well have been characters in a tale. Children chose sides, assembled play armies, staged wars in the streets. The Bad Queen against the Good Queen. Blood warring with light.
"Am I one of them?"
Riel had wondered, though she had never found the courage to ask Tal or her father outright.
"And which one?"
"You see, Lady Riel," said the king, "my charge is not to decide whether what you have done is a crime and whether or how you should be punished. It is that you seem to be neither Firebrand nor Sunspinner nor Earthshaker, but all of those things, and more, which is unprecedented. You performed magic more powerful than there has been in half an age. Even after spending 13 years being taught to suppress your abilities in the hope that they would disappear. And you did so without the aid of a casting, which is something not even the saints could manage at the height of their glory. My sacred duty, said the king, his face grave, is to determine what exactly you are. I must decide if you are one of these queens, and if so, which one?
Riel heard the unsaid words plainly. And what that will mean for you. She clenched her fists in her skirts and curtsied before the king, the shadow of Saint Catel falling like a sword across her neck. Chapter 10 Eliana. When darkest is the night, when lost is the fight, when blood is all in sight, look to the rising dawn. Van Teren Folk Song. Whenever Eliana dressed for one of Lord Arkelian's parties, she thought about her father. Joseph Ferracora had spent most of her childhood fighting on the Eastern Front as the Empire wore down the last of Ventera's resistance.
Every night he's gone. We'll leave lights in the windows for him, her mother had decided.
In those golden days before the invasion, before Remy, the distant war had felt no more real to Eliana than a ghost story.
But what will the lights do? Eliana asked.
They belong to the Sun Queen, Rosen explained, and will help bring your father safely back to us. So every night, before bed, Eliana had lit the candle in her window and whispered the Sun Queen's prayer. May the Queen's light guide him home. As she grew older, she came to dread her father's visits, for they became shorter, and they would always end. But she never stopped looking forward to the summer solstice, when Joseph would return for the annual festival, and most importantly, for the Sun Queen pageant. Before the fall, before the Blood Queen Riel died and left everything in ruins, the world was full of magic. So said the stories, and as a child, Eliana had believed in them with all her heart. They said people of the old world used shields and swords to summon wind and fire. They worshipped mighty saints who had banished the race of angels into oblivion, and they believed that a queen would someday save the world from evil. She was called the Sun Queen, for she would bring light into darkness. Even long after the age of the old world had ended, and it was understood that angels and magic did not exist, had never existed, that the legends of the old world were simply that. Many people still visited temples to pray to the saints, and the myth of the Sun Queen remained. And every summer, Joseph Ferracora returned home to his daughter, bringing with him some new ornament for her costume, a gilded hairpiece from Rinthos, a white mink pelt smuggled in from Astavar. Together, Eliana and her parents would join the parades crowding the city. Children with gold-dusted cheeks climbed up the crumbling statues of Saint Catel, the Sun Spinner, to leave garlands of gemma flowers around her neck. Musicians beat their drums and plucked their harps. White-robed storytellers performed tales of the Sun Queen's long-awaited coming. The parade ended at the high turn of the river, in the easternmost hills, where the statue of Audric the Lightbringer stood. He sat on his winged horse, sword in hand and somber eyes fixed on the eastern horizon. It was Eliana's favorite statue in the city, for the doomed king's face looked both brave and tired. Looking at him made her heart twist with pity.
I'm sorry, Lightbringer, she whispered to him,
that last year. She kissed his weathered stone boot, clutched her necklace bearing his ruined likeness in the other. As always, she searched for his face in the necklace's layers of wear, but while the winged horse was clear, the person riding it had been buried beneath the darkness of time, no matter how diligently Eliana tried to clean it. "Watch the horizon," Rosen had whispered to her daughter, an infant Remy asleep in her arms. "Do you see her? Do you see the Sun Queen?"
"Will she come this year, Papa?"
7-year-old Eliana had asked, elated even after the long night.
"Keep looking, sweet girl," Yosef had answered, his arms trembling around her. "Keep watching for the light."
He had left again for war the next day, and he had never returned. 10 years later, Eliana sat before the mirror in her bedroom as Remy finished twisting her wavy brown hair into a low knot. Her cheeks, not so pale as Remy's, closer to the warm olive tones of her mother, shimmered with silver powder. Dark coal rimmed her eyes. Diamonds glinted in each ear. She finished applying a rich red dye to her lips and smiled at her reflection.
"I look good,"
she declared. Remy rolled his eyes.
"You always look good." "Yes, but tonight it's really something, isn't it? I'm just going to keep rolling my eyes until you stop talking."
She grinned at him in the mirror.
"So, tell me once more."
Remy sulked on her bed.
"I'm supposed to stay with Harkon, no matter what, and do exactly as he tells me, no matter what. And not even think of asking you again about what you'll be doing tonight. No matter what."
Eliana stood, the wine-colored gown Lord Arkellion sent her falling in sparkling folds about her legs.
"And if something happens to Harkon, I wait for you at the East Bridge, by the Admiral's statue."
"But nothing will happen to Harkon," said the man himself, entering from the hallway. He wore tall brown boots, dark trousers, a long coat that hugged his trim torso, and a hooded cloak. He set down a small bag of supplies and ruffled Remy's hair. "Harkon's altogether too impressive for that."
Normally Remy would have rolled his eyes and told Harkon that the only impressive thing he could do was belch like a drunk old grandfather. But Remy sat silent and pale, his lips chapped from biting them. Since their mother's disappearance, he had not let anyone see him cry, had even bravely tried to match Eliana's jokes, but she knew better. If something went wrong, if anything happened to him or Harkon because of the deal she had made with Simon. She tucked her necklace into her dress, the pendant rough against her skin, and smoothed her features into a glittering mask.
"Remy," Harkon said, "why don't you go collect your things?"
"I'm not stupid," Remy muttered. "Just tell me to leave so you can talk."
"Fine. Leave so we can talk."
When Remy had gone, Harkon took Eliana's hand.
"Tell me you're not making a terrible mistake, trusting this man," he said quietly.
A thrill of nervousness rippled through her at the grave expression on his face.
"You know I can't tell you that."
"Good, because then I'd know you were lying."
Despite herself, she smiled, and when Harkon finally grinned back at her, she cupped his face in her hands and brought him down gently for a kiss. With his hands warm against her bare back, Eliana could almost believe this was just another night, going to a party with Harkon, dancing and flirting, and coming home with a job.
"We will find her, El."
Harkon kissed her temple and let her go, his eyes soft on her face.
"But first..."
"First," she said, trying on a smile, "I have a party to attend." In the evening ballroom of Lord Arkellion's palace, only a handful of small candles dotted the room, and the shivering floor spun with dancers. Large windows opened into the night, letting in the river breeze. Eliana pretended to sip her wine and scan the room, counting the motionless figures around the perimeter. Adatrox. 20 of them. Her mouth thinned. On a normal night, upward of 500 Adatrox patrolled the enormous palace and its sprawling grounds. But tonight, there would be close to 1,000. She continued counting. 30, 35. Mostly men, a few women, dark and pale, black cloaks and grey surcoats and blank-eyed stares that could turn murderous in an instant. An idol to the Emperor towered in a corner of the ballroom. Eliana, glaring at it, sent a quick prayer to Saint Tamarin of the Old World, the legendary shadowcaster and the patron saint of Astavar. The Empire could raise their temples to the ground and tear down their statues, but they could not police the prayers inside her head.
"Hide me, Tamarin," she prayed, "lady of swiftness and illicit deeds. If, that is, you ever actually existed."
Chiming tones floated in from the city's central plaza, the clock tower striking midnight. Eliana waited 5 minutes before drifting across the ballroom, smiling and making excuses whenever someone asked her for a dance. She made her way through the maze of candle-lit sitting rooms surrounding the ballroom, keeping one eye on the Adatrox patrolling the hallways. Then she slipped into a narrow servant's passage and followed the winding stone stairs to the palace's lower levels, the infirmary, the servants' quarters, the kitchens. Any servants she passed knew her well enough to look the other way. As she rounded the corner into a hallway stacked with crates of vegetables and sacks of flour, a tingle of nerves climbed up her spine. If this was all some elaborate trap of Simon's, if he betrayed her at the last minute and abandoned Remy and Harkin to certain death, well, she wouldn't be beaten without taking him down with her. She paused, listened to the bustle of the kitchens to make sure no one was approaching, then opened a heavy, locked door that led to a small stone supply yard. Simon slipped inside, wearing the Adatrox uniform Eliana had stolen for him. In the fitted surcoat, with the winged shield of the Empire emblazoned on his chest, he could have passed for one of the silent soldiers, except for that sharp light in his eyes and the way he moved. Sinuous and graceful, with none of the Adatrox's stiffness.
"At last," he said dryly. "I was beginning to worry."
"I find that unlikely."
She shut the door and swept past him, noticing with savage delight how his eyes trailed down her body. That could be useful later.
"Let's move."
She led him through the cramped servants' passages up to the third floor, where they emerged into the palace proper. The deep piled carpets muffled their steps. Music drifted through windows open to the vast gardens below. In the north wing, the walls turned red, the mouldings ornate. Gas lamps burned in jeweled casings. The air smelled of perfume. They turned a corner into a portrait gallery of black-eyed generals. At one end of the corridor hung a painting of the Emperor himself. Eliana's heart pounded. She had never been in the North Wing before. She couldn't shake the childish fear that the Emperor's painted black eyes were following her every step.
"Well," she said, "we're here. Now it's your turn."
Simon slipped past her.
"Watch and learn, little dread."
"Call me little again, and I'll punch you."
A smile twitched at his mouth.
"You know just how to entice me."
"Have you forgotten? My punches hurt."
"Forgotten? In fact, I relish the memory."
She scowled, but then they reached a set of wooden doors marked by an engraving of a naked woman, her cascading waves of hair masking her face, and Eliana froze.
"The maiden's fault."
She shot a look at Simon. Female concubines lived in this tower, their male counterparts in the south wing.
"Why?"
There's a girl inside, Simon explained, taking hold of Eliana's arm. Cover me while I retrieve her. Try not to get hurt. I won't have you slowing me down. Eliana bristled, as though he stood a chance of navigating back down through the castle without her.
Follow my lead, said Simon, knocking on the door.
Eliana nodded, ready to grab Arabeth from the slit in her skirt. The doors opened, revealing two Adatrochs, men, one pale, one dark. Their brows furrowed to see Simon. He shoved Eliana into the foyer. She kept her eyes obediently on the floor, her heart pounding.
What's this? Asked one of the Adatrochs. Special delivery, Simon answered smoothly, before pulling his sword from his belt and gutting both of them.
They dropped to the floor. Simon kicked the door shut behind him. A girl passing by the foyer, clad in gauzy silks, ran off shouting warnings. More Adatrochs rounded the corner. Simon ran at them, Eliana right on his heels. He took out one of the Adatrochs with a swift punch and a swipe of his blade. Eliana leapt at the other. The Adatrochs lunged at her, sword in hand. She sidestepped his thrust, stabbed him in the throat. He thudded to the floor, choking. Then his clouded gaze fell on her face and darkened, sharpened. A sick feeling swept over her. She staggered, unbalanced. She felt seen, as if the shadows around her cloaked secret eyes that had come awake to stare. The Adatrochs went still, his gaze blank and unseeing as he bled out on the floor. Whatever darkness had touched his eyes, it was now gone, or maybe had never been there at all. She turned and raced after Simon, following the sound of metal on metal down a wide hallway lined with embroidered drapes. She found him in a softly lit bathing room that smelled of jasmine and roses. Three Adatrochs surrounded him. She took care of one by opening his throat, then evaded the fists of another before sweeping his feet out from under him and kicking him in the head with the heel of her beaded sandal. A girl fled past her and the bleeding Adatrochs, then out the door, clutching a shawl to her chest and leaving a trail of red footprints behind her. Across the room, Simon struggled with another Adatrox. A group of girls was backed into the far corner, trapped with her and Simon between them and escape. One of them let out a sharp sob. Eliana scanned the frightened face of each girl. Which was the one Simon needed to retrieve? And why? What use was a concubine to the second highest-ranking member of Red Crown? Eliana felt the Adatrox in the doorway behind her before she saw him, barely turned in time to dodge his sword. She slipped in a pool of water on the floor and went down hard, banging her knee. Before Eliana could regain her balance, the Adatrox swung his sword in her direction once more, only to stumble back as a string of sapphires and diamonds landed around his neck. The person behind him pulled on the necklace, hard, and the Adatrox dropped his sword to claw at his throat, gagging. Eliana picked up his sword and ran it through his heart. He collapsed. She looked up and met the gaze of a girl holding the necklace, at the end of which dangled an enormous opal. The girl's skin was a warm brown, her hair black, her eyes a pale hazel. Though she wore nothing but a blood-spattered, sheer blue slip and dark gold maiden's marks on her wrists, she had the bearing of a queen.
You're welcome, the girl said, breathless.
Simon stormed over.
Good. You've met.
He took the girl by the arm and moved toward the door.
This way.
Eliana sheathed Arabeth and followed them.
My name is Navi, the girl said, smiling back at Eliana as Simon hurried her out of the room.
But Eliana did not reply, for when she glanced back at the open windows of the bathing room, she saw a figure drop down from the roof to land on the terrace outside. Tall and thin,
with creamy, pale skin and fair hair tied back in one long braid, dressed all in black, save for a blood-red dress cloak that swept the ground. Razavel.
Chapter 11. Riel. Of Ayava's prophecy, there are many interpretations. Some dismiss his dying words as the nonsense ramblings of a great angelic mind gone to ruin. But all scholars do agree on this. Despite the war dividing their people, the blood of both humans and angels that stained their hands, the angel Ayava loved Saint Katel, the sun spinner, and that love saved us all. A discourse on the prophecy of Ayava, as translated by Grand Magister Isabeau Bazinet, of the Holdfast, transcribed on October 6th, year 12, of the Second Age. After 2 hours, the king declared a recess, and Riel's guards escorted her into one of the hall's antechambers. She sank into the first chair she saw, so tired she felt ill. The councils had attacked her with questions. What it felt like to manipulate so many elements at once, and all with the same body. If singing the wind felt different than controlling fire or shaking the earth, or was it all the same to her? What sort of lessons had Tal given her over the years? Oh, he had tried to kill her on occasion, to test her restraint. How had he done that, and how many times? How had she fought the instinctive desire to save herself? What a marvelous testament to her control. And where, they asked, had that control been out on the race course? They had let her sit for at least some of the questioning, but she still felt as exhausted as if she had ridden the entire chase all over again, twice. Just as her eyes started drifting shut, the doors flew open, and Audric entered the room. "Leave us," he told the guards. The guards did not move. There was a beat of silence in which everything hung suspended. "I think if Lady Riel wanted to kill me," Audric snapped, "she would have done it years ago." "Leave us." The guards left at once. Riel was now entirely awake. She stood, her heart thundering. Where to even begin with him? "Audric," she said, her voice coming out frayed. "I'm sorry I didn't tell you."
"I understand why you didn't."
"God, Riel, I..."
"Please, don't apologize. Are you all right?"
She let out a soft huff of laughter.
"Not entirely."
Audric came to her, cradled her hands in his. His thumb brushed against her wrist like a kiss.
"I cannot forgive them for doing this to you."
Every gentle press of his fingers made Riel's stomach twist.
"Father, and Tal?"
"They should be ashamed of their cowardice."
"Well, I'm sure Tal is, anyway."
"Good."
"They thought they were doing what was best."
Audric frowned.
"For the kingdom?"
"Of course."
"And for you?"
She hesitated. How many times had she asked this question of her father, only to be shamed into silence?
"My happiness is unimportant compared to the safety of those around me."
"Unimportant?"
Audric released her, dragging a hand through his dark curls.
"That's what they've been telling you all these years."
Suddenly, the air around them felt charged. Riel's fingers prickled from the nearness of magic. The air bloomed with heat. Riel caught the slightly singed scent of sunspinner magic, a blazing noon sky, a hot summer's day. Audric's eyes snapped to hers before he turned away, his shoulders high and tense. He moved to the window, placed his palm against the sun-warmed glass. When he looked back to her, his face was not quite so furious, and the air had calmed.
Your happiness is important, Riel, he said softly. And I am sorry I didn't see what was happening this entire time.